My name is Claire Press, and this is Wardrobe Crisis, the podcast that unzips fashion's issues. Are we starting?
We are seeing a kind of almost Zoolander-esque caricature of how excessive fashion can be.
Our love shifting was like 16 to 20 hours a day. I would work like 450 hours in a month and making only $6.
Creativity is one of the most powerful things that humans have.
We underestimate the power of beauty and the power of humor. These are qualities that connect people, and connectivity is a really potent thing right now.
Don't point a finger, impart knowledge and information instead.
Plus size modeling can go suck it.
It's our job as designers to explore and discover beauty everywhere.
So your voice is crucial and powerful in the supply chain.
Join me every week as we talk ethics, sustainability, and the business and madness of fashion. From who made your clothes to how they impact on the environment to the politics of personal style. We are so hot right now.
Oh, it's getting hot. My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I don't go away because everything is just fine.
I never wanted to be a fashion blogger. I mean, I'm probably just too old, but mostly it didn't resonate with me, the idea of taking a lot of pictures of myself and, I don't know, telling you what bag to buy. I guess I did that in magazines, but, you know, it wasn't for me. But I did like the renegade spirit of the early blogs and the fact that the people who made them were independent and untethered from mainstream media, I guess. But in a way, I think I felt a bit let down by how few of them rocked the fashion boat. Like, they had all this power because they were untethered and untrammeled, but I'm not sure that they really used it to be kind of rabble-rousing. Which brings me to podcasts. I think that's what I hope I'm doing. Anyway, I reckon that podcasts have got something in common with the first wave of blogs, mostly because they're independent, or many of them are. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm enjoying myself so much in this new realm. It's because I'm my own boss. I can talk to or interview who I like. I'm not worrying about clickbait or what's popular. What's possible I'm worrying about, but not what's popular. I'm not worried about wooing or offending advertisers. I'm just talking to the people I find most intriguing. So is that what makes this work? You tell me. Is it about the honesty behind what I'm trying to do, that it's real? I hope so. What else do I love about podcasting? Another part of it for me is community, that this is a conversation that you can all join in with. And I get these amazing messages from people who've enjoyed the show, and that's kind of what keeps me going. And you do need to be kept going because it's hard work and, you know, you don't get paid. It's like a labor of love. And I'm not saying that to be some weird martyr, but that's just the truth of what we do with podcasting. Most of us who are not allied to a big media company or who haven't got a bazillion advertisers jumping on their huge traffic. So yeah, that's kind of the context for the conversation that you're going to hear, which is one of my favorite conversations I've had. Oh, they're all my favorites, but I think you're really going to love it. In this episode, we're going to hear from a podcasting pioneer in the sustainable fashion space, and that is Kestrel Jenkins, the force behind Conscious Chatter. When I started this Wardrobe Crisis podcast, one of the first things I thought was, how do I make it different from Conscious Chatter? Because, you know, Kestrels, she's a leader in the sustainable fashion space. She's got over, I think it's 70 episodes, and it's fantastic. She's a great interviewer, and she's interviewed from brilliant thinkers, and she's already done it, you know, she's great. So it's like, how do I make it different? And I think I'm doing that. But one of the really lovely things that happened is that we connected. And this is another thing that's about how awesome podcasting is. It's not really competitive like the kind of weird old magazine mentality. It's a community. People love connecting. People love to kind of share because it's a conversation and you can't have a conversation with yourself. And so this cool thing happened. We connected and decided to interview each other. I love it. And I love her. So in this episode, we discuss the power of the podcast, who we think is listening and why, and how we keep them tuned in or how we try. We talk about our perspectives on ethical fashion, and we've got heaps in common, and it's a real treat to hear how Kestrel built her world, how she got started, and what makes her tick. Kestrel, I like how one of your favourite words is curious. And when I listen to Conscious Chat, I always smile when I hear you say it, because curiosity is one of the greatest qualities we humans can have. What do you think about curiosity? We need more of it, right? Were you a curious child?
Yes, absolutely. I do say that word a lot. And sometimes when I'm going back and editing the podcast, I'm like, oh, you said it again. But it's one of those things that it's just in me. When I was a kid, I was always outside playing and going on adventures and creating forts. And I just had a mental image come to mind of when I built and I was learning about the Iditarod.
About the what? Sorry?
The Iditarod, which is something that happens in Alaska every year. It's basically like a dog sled race.
Right.
And so this friend of mine and I found like an old game, and we converted it into basically a dog sled by putting it onto two skis. And then we told my brother that he had to be the dog, and we had a rope attached to it, and he had to pull us around.
That is a great image.
It was great. But I mean, I guess that kind of sums up some of the random things that I would do as a kid.
I love it. I mean, I'd never even heard of that, but that does show an imaginative child who's always curious. And I think that word is key to this thing of being a journalist and wanting to tell stories, isn't it? You want to dig into finding out things that you don't know and pinning people down and getting them to spill the beans about stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess for me, I've always wanted to understand the full picture. And so I think that's why supply chains are really interesting to me, because there's all these different layers and different components. And for me, if someone tells me one thing that's part of a larger puzzle, I'm always initially wanting to say, well, how does that fit into the bigger picture? And why does that happen like this? And how does it affect all of these other elements? And a lot of times people don't necessarily want to answer those questions.
Yeah, everything's connected. I do like that as well. And also I read like that, you know, when you read something and then it will lead you to another book and it will lead you to another book and another book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. That's the fun of words too, how it can connect to you like that.
Yes. Were you a voracious reader as a child?
I was a reader, but I wouldn't say voracious. I was one of those kids that couldn't sit still for very long. So,
You were outdoors?
I was outside running around. I was playing sports. I was playing like monkeys. I was a huge fan of chimpanzees. It was my thing. And, you know, Jane Goodall was my big time idol. And I actually got to meet her when I was in fifth grade.
Oh, wow.
And it was like this huge thing for me to be a fifth grader and get her autograph and meet her. So like I knew all of her chimps, and I knew all the chimps that she worked with, and I knew all their names and their stories. So I guess I always have wanted to learn the stories behind things, but for me to sit down and read a full book was always challenging.
Yeah, right. Where did you grow up as a child? You mentioned Alaska, but I know you grew up in Minnesota. Can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what it was like?
Yeah, I grew up in Wisconsin, which is right next door to Minnesota.
All right.
It's very, very close. And you can see Minnesota from my parents' house, actually. I grew up right on the Mississippi River in an old house. My parents were really into old buildings and renovating them and kind of appreciating old things. And my parents, when I was 1 year old, they purchased this old building in this tiny town along the river and decided to turn it into a restaurant and hotel. So I grew up around a lot of different people, because a lot of people would be traveling through, and I would always be meeting different new people and always meeting musicians and hearing different music. So I guess while I grew up in a tiny town of like 1,200 people population, I did grow up with a lot of exposure to different people.
Yeah. A window in another world, a window in passing worlds, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Do you think that's where you got the travel bug? Because I know, just to jump forwards a bit, that you traveled, you taught, didn't you teach English in Spain?
Yeah, I did. I had a Fulbright scholarship to Spain for a year and lived in Madrid. I mean, I think that it came from partially that window from growing up with all of these people from around the world passing by, but also my parents were into travel. And because we were a business in a small town in Wisconsin, in the winter, things kind of slowed down. And so we would often go on some sort of a vacation in the winter, because that was the only time that they could take a break from working. And we went to Costa Rica, we went to Mexico, we did a lot of traveling. And I was really fortunate to have that exposure. And I think that kind of just set me up. And once I had just a little taste of it, it was in my blood.
Where does your interest in fair trade come from? Because I know that that was kind of the conduit for you getting into this idea of ethical fashion. Where did you discover the concept of fair trade and how?
Yeah, so during college, I studied global studies and international journalism. And I guess a primary pillar of that program was really thinking about how a product or an idea or a person moves around the world and how it interacts with other people and places along the way and vice versa, and kind of how those impacts happen on each other. And so I guess through that program, I was very aware of the way things are so often not treated fairly. And so after college, I really wanted to work somehow in fair trade in some sort of component. And I didn't honestly have a clue what it was going to be or who I was going to work for. I was kind of at a loss. And I was back at home and my mom got a catalog from a company called Fair Indigo, which was actually a collection of people who had worked for Land's End, and which is, I don't know if you're familiar, it's kind of like a very basic kind of mom and child sort of company.
Right.
Kind of like an REI, I guess. So anyways, this group of people had left Land's End and started this company, which was all fair trade clothing and accessories. And so my mom got this catalog and she's like, Kes, what about fashion? And it was like this huge light bulb exploded in my head. And I was like, whoa, this is the fusion of, you know, the things I love in the world. And so at that point, I did a ton of research online and just scoured the internet looking for companies that were doing things like that, and found PeopleTree as, you know, kind of the pioneer in fair trade fashion. And I was like, all right, I'm interning with you. This is happening. Somehow I have to make it happen. And I was the annoying American girl, and I emailed them basically every week just to check in and see if I can maybe get that internship until it happened.
Persistence wins out. I want to get onto PeopleTree, but you said that this was like a feeling of culmination of all the things that you were interested in. But where does your interest in fashion stem from? Did you know much about the industry? Were you obsessed with style? Where does it come from?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure where it comes from. My mom was always a really cool dresser, and I always looked up to her, as well as her mom, when I see photos of her. But
describe me an outfit of Linda's heyday.
Oh, okay. So she had this printed, like faded blue long skirt that had bells on it, and then a matching print, but the fabric was quilted and the top was a vest.
Yeah. I can see it.
Just,
that's like classic sort of 70s, 80s sort of hippie.
Definitely. Definitely. Hippie. If you saw my parents' wedding photos, you would know they came straight out of the hippie era.
Yeah, right. And so as a kid or as a teenager, paint me a picture of Kestrel's style.
So when I was a kid, even when I was probably four or five years old, if anyone would come to our house, I would go up to my room and change my outfit like up to five times while they were there. I would go and I would put on a different whole ensemble, and I would come down and kind of like walk around and then go do it again. So I guess I just had this, it was kind of my creative outlet from a young age. It was a way of creating something and putting something together. And I think it comes from, like, I have a lot of creative energy, but at the same time, I don't have a lot of patience. And so it's easy for me to put things together quickly and like grab from all these different things and create something versus actually taking the time and sewing something or,
yeah,
you know, doing a form of art that takes more time. So
I'm fascinated by this kind of idea of clothing as personal expression and of how we evolve our own personal style. But that is so different to the commercial beast that is the fashion industry. How did you fare when you rocked up at PeopleTree and you're suddenly in London and you're at the heart of a fair trade business, but still a commercial fashion business, which is all about a lot of different stuff way beyond this whole idea of personal expression through style?
Yeah, but at the same time, the city of London is just so full of inspiration, at least for me. When I was there, I feel like my style took a whole new turn and I was far more brave, and I just was doing things that I never would have imagined I could do or pull off in the US. So for me, I felt like every day I could go to the office and wear something crazy and people would be like, oh yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, that's so true about London.
So I got that kind
Where did you live?
I lived on the East End. I lived very close to Great Eastern Street.
Right. So were you into markets? Were you into vintage?
Yes, I was very into vintage. I was always going to the vintage shops. I was always going to the markets. When I would go to the markets, I always was, you know, asking the person selling, like, if they made the pieces and if I could learn the story. And I think, you know, that's one of the...
Curiosity.
There you go again. I just, but like curiosity that's connected to story, because for me, it's always been, I love stories. And as much as I don't sit down and read enough, I love oral history and oral stories. And, you know, my dad is such a good storyteller. And I grew up around the dinner table hearing the craziest stories of him when he was in Africa on a bird study or in Mexico. And, you know, I think that's kind of ingrained in me, is just being able to tell a story really well and then also being able to listen and learn from those stories.
That makes so much sense that you have embraced this medium of podcasting. I mean, I was asking you before about books because I'm a bookish woman who's always been locked in a room alone with a book. But this idea of oral storytelling makes absolute sense with the world that you've created for yourself.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like totally happenstance because I never had the idea myself to start a podcast. I was on and off listening to podcasts, and I always have loved radio. I worked for a radio station during college in Minnesota, and I knew some basics about it, but I never thought I would make a podcast or thought I had the skills for it. And a friend of mine who has like an organic and hemp t-shirt company, he was looking for podcasts that would talk about this kind of content. And he was like, Kes, you should start a podcast and talk about what you already talk about. And I was initially like, yeah, cool idea. Probably not going to happen. But I did a little research and I was like, all I have to do is buy a microphone for $100 and I can start it. So I did that.
It sort of, when you describe it in that way, it makes me think about that question, which I warned you I was going to ask, which is, are podcasts the new blogs? But if you think about blogging, it was always about being untethered. You could be anywhere and you could be creating your own content. You didn't have to be allied to Condé Nast or in London working for, I don't know, whoever. You could just be this girl in a bedroom creating these fantastic stories anywhere in the world. That's the same kind of thinking behind podcasts, isn't it? Like, you're not restricted by your geographical location or by, I don't know, we were talking before about by your armies of assistants or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think also there's something unique about podcasting where, you know, it's different from YouTube, it's different from blogs, because you can just put in your headphones and you can listen while you're doing something else. And I think for a lot of people that either use their hands for their work or are traveling a lot or moving a lot, they can just put in their headphones and they can be, you know, part of a conversation at the same time.
What makes a good conversation in the podcast world?
I think unscripted and just genuine conversations. I mean, I think honesty is something that so often we lose today, because you look on Instagram and everyone has a crafted identity, and you look on Facebook and there's a crafted identity. And even when we wear clothes, like, we're crafting an identity. And I think there's something that you can get deeper when it comes to audio, because there's no other, like, there's no visual interfering with the conversation. Yeah. It's like very intimate, and it's just words and it's just voices. And I feel like there are less preconceived notions that can arise from those conversations.
I love that. And also, I was thinking, as you said, that you can't hide. So when you talk about social media, Instagram, Facebook, whatever it is, often people do, as you say, craft these kind of almost fake personas, my beautiful fake life that I'm not really living, right? But you can't do that in a podcast. You're basically there on the spot having to answer, having to talk and having to be authentic. And people can hear it if you're full of, I want to say, are we allowed to say that on air? I don't know. I love how I say on air. I love how my husband's like, you're not on air. You need to get with the modern era. But yeah, do you think it is about that authenticity that there is, in a sense, nowhere to hide and you've got to really be your honest self?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. And also, I think that intimacy allows people to tune in if they're unfamiliar with a conversation, for instance, and not feel as intimidated. So, you know, this conversation, the conversation about the fashion industry is overwhelming. And a lot of times it can turn people off when it's like, did you know this fact? And did you know that fact? And how horrible fashion can be to people in the planet.
Yeah.
I mean, that can be a massive turnoff because it's overwhelming. And so you want to shut it down. But if you tune into a podcast, you can just put in your headphones. No one has to know what you're listening to. And you can kind of just expose yourself gradually. And maybe you want to keep listening and maybe you don't. But I think it's an easy way to kind of like get your feet wet.
That's a beautiful way of explaining it. I wanted to ask about that intimacy and ask about your mum, Linda. You, in your very first episode, became your first guest and your mum is the interviewer, which I think is just the cutest thing ever. That was actually the way that I got really into conscious chatter, because I heard that episode and was like, yes, there's something so real about this.
Yeah, there was something really real about the audio quality too, because that was my first podcast and I had no idea what I was doing. But I think it's kind of cool to see the progression since then. But my mom has been an inspiration to me as far as style goes forever. And she really was the one that planted the seed as far as this idea of fashion being an avenue for me to pursue and kind of fuse that with, you know, social responsibility and fair trade and that kind of thing. So I thought it was best to have her interview me because she really kind of got me on this path.
Did you write her questions?
It was a collaboration, actually, because I was like, well, what are some of the things that you want to ask? And at the same time, she's so sensitive. She's like, I don't want to say something or ask you something that you don't feel comfortable with. This is your show. And I was like, yeah, but I want you to ask whatever you think of. And so it was a collaboration. But yeah, she's a pretty impressive woman. She used to be a kindergarten teacher. And when I was born, like I had mentioned, I was about a year old and my dad decided to suggest that they start a restaurant, and they did it and pulled it off. And she's one of those people that's very able to adjust to situations, and she's such a hard worker. I think having parents like that has been so key to me to try to build something like this without really having funding.
Yeah, we'll talk about funding later. There isn't any. Anyone listening? Labor of love. That's what you got to do to make this work. But I want to ask you about strong women, because obviously your mum has been a very strong influence in your life. What about some of the other strong women who have shaped your thinking? And you mentioned Jane Goodall, who is obviously a kind of icon in the environmentalist movement. But what about Safia Minni? So coming back to your time that you spent as an intern at PeopleTree, I also love that you interview Safia Minni in one of your early Conscious Chatter episodes. Tell me about what you admire about her and her process and approach to fair trade and fashion.
Yeah, I mean, Safia is one of the trailblazers in this industry. And when I kind of started learning about the concept of fair trade and it being connected to fashion, I found Safia's blog, which is a little bit different now, but at the time, PeopleTree was earlier on and Safia would write a weekly blog and I would just wait for it to come out. I would be like, every day that I knew it was going to launch, I'd be on the website excited to read it, because I just felt like she was doing something so unique that wasn't being discussed. It was like she was doing something underground that no one was acknowledging as something that needed to be addressed yet. And I remember working in the office in London, and she's one of those women that just has a very clear vision of what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. And I just remember like the click of her heels running across the floor all the time. She'd be like buzzing here and there and here and there, and just like telling people three words, like, do this thing. Can you do this thing? Can you do this thing? She's a force. And I guess being able to, you know, learn from her and get some insight from her in person was really powerful to me. I remember she asked me if I could take her place at a fair trade conference that was happening in Wales. And so I would have to take the train and go and give this PowerPoint presentation.
Wow.
And to me at the time, I was like, whoa, this is so unbelievably humbling. And
I'm like that now. I'm like that hearing that now. That's full on. Did you do it?
Yes, I did it.
Well done.
So
was it nerve-wracking?
It was definitely nerve-wracking. But at the same time, she primed me and she's like, you know all of these things already, you'll be good. And she was very optimistic and, you know, encouraging.
Yeah, right.
And
that's cool. But she gave you the tools.
She gave me the tools, exactly.
Which other strong women do you admire and why?
That's a great question.
While you think of an answer, I'm going to say another woman who you have interviewed, who is Ursula de Castro. She's someone I admire greatly. I've also interviewed her, and she was one of the founders of Fashion Revolution. And her, for listeners who aren't aware of Ursula's background, she had this fantastic upcycled label called From Somewhere, which was basically built around this idea of fixing up fabrics that had been discarded. She actually was inspired originally by crocheting around the holes in an old sweater in order to lend it future beauty and longevity. I love her, and she speaks so compellingly about, I guess, the horror of waste in the industry, but also about our responsibility to do things right. So I love her.
Yeah. Who do you love? I do love her. You know, I love Elizabeth Klein. She wrote Overdressed.
Oh, yeah, I've read her book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
And she's got a really true edge to her, which is refreshing in this industry. And she's really into analytics and really breaking down the facts, which I think so often we struggle with in this industry, is having those facts.
Oh, yeah. Fashion people don't like the statistics.
Yeah, but they're so necessary in this conversation to push it forward.
You consistently push this conversation forward through your work at Conscious Chatter. What is it about slow fashion that makes you galvanized? Why do we need slow fashion?
I guess for me, it's just like I'm so far deep into it. I can't imagine a future looking any different than a shift in this direction. You know, I mean, I recently talked to Stefan, who is the founder of Not Just a Label, and he was just, you know, bringing up the fact that we can't change the system. We can't work in the system and change it. Like, there's no way to move forward that way. We literally have to break it and rebuild it.
Oh, wow.
And okay. I guess hearing that from someone who's on the cusp of what's coming up next, because he is like the guy who gets access to all of the newest designers. Like, they're the biggest platform for emerging designers around the world. And to hear that from someone like him was powerful. And I guess it also gave me a little bit more hope that maybe that is on the horizon.
Mm. I always talk about trying to change the system from within. So for me, it's interesting to hear stories about people who are saying, no, we can't even do it. We need to smash it down and build a new one in a better mode.
Yeah, well, I think it's just right now there's been so many conversations about the fashion industry as a whole being so broken. You know, you hear about all the retail stores that are closing down on a regular basis. Like,
half,
for instance,
of American malls are supposedly going to close within
gnarly.
The next 50 years. Yeah.
It's crazy. There's going to be all this space, too. There's going to be all this wide open, empty space. And what are we going to do with it? I don't think that entirely halting consumption is the solution or is ever going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, if I think about myself, I am a huge promoter of buying less and like being conscious about what you're deciding to buy and, you know, having a good think about it before you actually make that purchase. But at the same time, like I said earlier, fashion is my form of art. So I love beautiful things and I need them in my life for happiness too. And that maybe is selfish in a sense, but at the same time, you know, there's certain things that are part of joy and goodness and just bring you good feelings that you need to have.
Just to take you back there to that conversation around consumption, do you want to tell us a little bit about your year that you spent consuming only conscious fashion?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. It was just after I had been in London and working with PeopleTree. And at the time, I was very extreme. I was in this mindset that I didn't want to buy anything that wasn't checking so many boxes. Like, it needed to be fair trade. The fabric needed to be organic or recycled. I was very diligent in, if I was going to buy something, it had to check all these boxes. And in turn, because of that, at the time, so this is probably 10 or so years ago now, there weren't that many options. And so I did a lot of thrifting and, you know, borrowing and that kind of thing to get through the year. And every week I would post a different outfit and kind of share the story behind that. And for me, I think what I learned the most was really that simple idea you hear a lot, that creativity can come from constraints, because having less options really helped me get crazy with what I had, because for me, I love like the composition of an outfit. It's just something that is so, it just like feeds my soul, basically. And so in order to get those interesting compositions, I really had to get creative and, you know, maybe cut up some things that I had and, you know, put different things together that I never would have expected and layer in creative ways. And I think it actually has really inspired a lot of what my style is today.
Have you ever dabbled in those other restrictive wardrobe experiments like the capsule wardrobe, or I know, you know, buy nothing new, or what about the 333 thing?
Yeah, I'm familiar with a lot of them, and I actually haven't. I'm very aware of what I'm buying, and often I don't buy anything for quite a while, and then I'll suddenly have this spurt where I'm like, oh, I need this, 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 and this, which obviously I don't need them, but but mentally I'm like, oh, I need these pieces because I need these quality pieces to be in my wardrobe because I feel like they're important to what I need to say to the world. And so I will kind of like go through this spree and I'll find all of these pieces after a long process of finding them and determining if they're the right ones. And then people will be like, whoa, you just bought all this stuff. Like some of my friends, they're like, they're so surprised by it. And I'm like, I just had a little moment. Now I'm good.
I love that. That's honest. I love the fact that you're admitting that. I mean, we've all done it. Like, it's ridiculous to pretend that we're all, you know, absolutely pristine angels who never fall victim to kind of marketing either, you know. I know you weren't actually saying that you do this, but I do it. Sometimes I look in my inbox and there's an email that comes through from Net-a-Porter or wherever it is, and it's like, 5 spring sandals you need now. And I think, oh my God, do I need them? Do I need the sandals? Do I need 5 or just 1 of the 5? Ah!
Well, they keep telling us we need them. What are we supposed to think?
Okay, so how then, as an ethical fashionista and as someone who has dug deep into the issues around sustainability and sustainable brands, how would you suggest that listeners navigate that balance between trying to feel like they're up with the trends and responding to these messages that marketing drives to them? How would they balance that with shopping ethically and sustainably? What would be some tips you could share? And maybe you could mention some independent American sustainable brands that you are particularly interested in at the moment.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when it comes to price points, I think thrifting or swapping, finding vintage shops is probably the most economical option. Still, as much as I wish it wasn't, there are more and more brands coming to this table that have a reduced price, but at the same time, I don't love all of them. And so I only buy things if I really, really love them. And that's one way that my consumption has shifted. And I guess you need to figure out your personal style and what is it you want to say to the world. And it doesn't have to be the same thing every day. Like, I decide to be someone different every day through what I'm wearing. And I love that. And I think that's the fun of it. But, you know, you just have to look at your closet and think about what you really need in there and how you can arrange it so it will work for you. And it's hard for me to have specific tips because I think style is so personal.
Yeah.
And it's intimate. And I think that's where I always have a hard time figuring out the balance between suggesting options to be more conscious and then also, you know, not taking away from someone's personal aesthetic, because that's huge for me, is like being able to say what you want to say to the world.
And also not being part of that marketing pressure as well, being part of that conversation that says you must have this thing, otherwise you are less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess, I mean, I still pay attention to trends. I pay attention to magazines. I watch bloggers. I find it entertaining to always see what different people are wearing. But more recently, it's gotten a bit boring because I think we have so much access to everyone else and seeing what everyone else around the world is doing, that there's so much sameness, there's so much replication. And for me, like, I get excited when I see something totally different that I had never seen before. So yeah, like, there's a designer named Mia Vesper, and she's out of New York, and she sources tapestries, vintage tapestries from around the world, and then she upcycles them.
Yeah.
Oh, they're so beautiful. And they're like way beyond my price point. Like, I cannot afford them. I wish I could sometime in the future, because I understand the work that goes into them. But at the same time, like, that's for me, like, that's something I can totally appreciate. It's an artistic, beautiful thing.
You are at the moment, I believe, working on a label of your own. Is that right?
Yes, it's called Left Edit. Both my co-founder and myself are left-handed. It's going to be starting as a women's wear line, but actually not a line, only one piece. So one design. We're starting very simple. We have our basic idea in mind, and we're still working out all of the details, and we're actually in the fabric sourcing process right now. And it's funny, my co-founder is always saying, you know, it's like having all of your expertise and knowledge and sustainability is a blessing and a curse, because
yeah.
I know so much. So we get different fabrics, and then I'm thinking, oh, well, we can't use this because of this, or this doesn't really make sense because of that. And it's kind of like, it's a great conversation that we've been having back and forth, because it's challenging. And it's been really interesting for me to kind of get a bird's eye view into what so many designers have been struggling with for years. And there's so many more options out there now than there were, but at the same time, they're few and far between. And what we're really pushing for is a really good balance of fit and quality, which are two things that we feel like have been missing from the conversation and from what's showing up to the table. So we're working on it, and I hope that we have a prototype soon.
How on earth do you start a brand which is based on a single style?
We came up with an idea of something that would be really versatile. Mm-hmm. And so it's a one piece that can be used multiple ways.
Okay.
And I think initially that concept tends to make you think it's going to be like this knit piece that can be worn as a scarf and then can be worn as like a skirt. And that's totally not what we're thinking. So I think it's hard to share the basic information without having the piece, because I think it builds this idea in your mind that's really what we're not trying to build.
Watch this space. when do you think, do you have any idea of when we might be able to see it?
We're hoping within the next 4 months or so, we'll have something more concrete.
Cool.
To share. Yeah.
So you never studied fashion, right? How did you go about it? Has your partner got a design background?
Yeah, she has a design background. She has a background in making things. She used to have a turban company where she handmade turbans and had an Etsy shop, but she did really well. But she's also like a master marketer. And so she worked for an agency in town. And I guess we come from very different backgrounds, but have very complementary elements. And we both are as obsessed with this conversation as each other. And we also aren't afraid to ask for help. So, you know, we're communicating with different designers to get help along the way. And I think that's something key in today's world, is that we don't need to think that we have to have all of the answers and know every single step of the process. And I find that it can open so many more doors and can also like allow you to just excel at what you're good at and let other people do the work that you're not as talented at.
That's a good perspective. I agree with that. And also the idea that, and again, coming back to the way that social media presents people's lives in a fake way, people suspect that other people who have great success just got there in a moment and it wasn't hard and that they knew everything off the bat. That's not how it works at all. Everyone has to figure stuff out, trial and error, until they get there, right?
Yeah, it's a long process, an ongoing forever process, right?
Looking at your process or your story of working in the ethical fashion space for how many years is it since you were interning at PeopleTree? Is it 7 or something?
I think 11.
Oh, 11. Okay. So over that period, how much change have you witnessed? And I know it's a lot, but I wonder if you could just share a little bit about the changes you've seen in terms of the sustainable fashion space and people's interest in the subject.
Yeah, for me, I feel like it's so powerful how much it's shifted. Sometimes when I step back and think about it, it's outstanding. And I think for, you know, those trailblazers like Safia, it has to be really, really outstanding for them. But I mean, when I interned with PeopleTree and came back to the US, I had my little bit of a British accent, and I would be, you know, sharing stories with friends and family about what I had been doing. And so often the response was confusion, and people just couldn't wrap their head around it. And I would try to, you know, break it down and be like, oh, you know, like organic food, but clothes. And it was really challenging. And over time, the number of brands that have showed up, like when I got back from London, I was working in New York, and I work for EcoChair and Inhabitat online publications for a couple of years. And at the time, I was writing about brands a lot. And so I literally knew every single brand out there. that was even entering the social responsibility realm, even if they were just like donating, even if they had like a donating arm to the company, I knew about them. And now, like, I can't keep up. There are brands that are launching every single day all over the world. And as much as I still think there's voids and there are ways that we can kind of elevate it, I guess for me, it's just, it's humbling to see how many people care about this and care to put in the time and the work to try to build something better.
I read a quote with you in an interview that you'd given with an online blog or site where you said that the phrase sustainable fashion doesn't ring true to you and you're looking forward to getting to a point where it's just fashion and we don't have to use that prefix.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a dream for a while because automatically it turns people off when a lot of people, when you say, oh yeah, like I'm really into sustainable fashion. And sometimes nowadays people get a little bit interested because they want to know what that is. But also a lot of times they're like, what does that even mean? Like, why is it sustainable? And then they automatically craft these images of what that means, like a hemp sack. And
are we still there? Are we still having that conversation?
Unfortunately, I think we still are there when it comes to getting outside of this bubble, you know? I mean, I guess I would rather just be that there are really cool stories behind brands and we celebrate that more than having to be like, this is the sustainable fashion option that we offer in our store.
Yeah, there's a bit in your interview with Safiya Minid, which I really liked, where you said that when you're in London, which was a long time ago, you would see regularly eco-fashion sort of listings in conventional magazines and newspapers. And then when you got back to the States, it was like, that does not exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like the Tube newspaper, the little newspaper you get every morning on the train, it had an eco fashion pick. And I was, you know, it was like new to the conversation and trying to find everything I could to read about it. And to see that every day, I was like, whoa, this is so advanced. And yeah, and then when I got back to the States, it was like no one could even kind of comprehend the conversation. There definitely were people working on it, but they were few and far between. And it wasn't like it is now. I mean, you look at the media and we hear stories and we read stories about the garment industry. Like it happens, it's in mainstream media. Whereas for a while there, it was nowhere to be found.
What do you think the next great conversation is? Because I feel like we've now reached, I'm not saying the work is done by any means, it absolutely isn't, but we have now reached a sort of popular comprehension of the fact that the fashion industry has got some inherent unsustainable, unethical issues around it. What's the next thing? Because I feel like furniture's coming. I feel like who has these conversations around interiors or fast furniture, is that even a thing? Who's asking the questions about how your sofa was made and where the leather was tanned on your cheap cushions? I wonder, what do you think?
You know, I think that furniture is already almost further along than fashion.
Do you? We never hear it here.
Well, I guess I feel like it kind of got connected to the architecture conversation. And at least in the US, you know, the industry that took off in communicating about sustainability was architecture. Because
buildings, right.
Buildings, you could validate that this is a good direction to go because it's going to save you money and it could take off that way. And I think because of that, it kind of has inspired the interior as well. I mean, if you look at West Elm in the US, I don't know if you have West Elm there, but it's a furniture and home goods store and they are very adamant about bringing transparency to the conversation and working with artisans in different parts of the world and telling those stories.
Are they?
And they're a very mainstream brand. And so I guess for me to see that and to see Whole Foods is similar, they're trying to do this. And these are massive companies. So, you know, there's always a bit of skepticism that goes with what they're saying to try to really try to understand if these elements are happening and how well they're happening. But I think the next one is like fashion still.
Yeah.
I think it's not there yet. I think I get stuck in this bubble sometimes and then I walk outside of it into an outside bubble. I'm like, oh, whoa, I gotta get out of my bubble more.
I feel like that often. Yeah, it can be very misleading to be constantly talking to people who are engaged with these issues, because as soon as you step outside of your box, you find that lots of people just don't know.
The thing is, there are so many messes in the world. And
absolutely,
I think we can't put so much pressure on consumers to have to know everything. I mean, we have to keep trying to give them information and give them access to more options. But I think that there's so much of a mess everywhere, and we're always hearing about another mess. And I think sometimes people just shut down.
I agree. What keeps you awake at night, if anything?
Well, currently what keeps me awake at night is, how do I make this podcast create a sustainable source of income? Because, okay, I'm talking about sustainability, I'm talking about building a better future for fashion all the time, but I'm not really building that for myself. And so I guess in the recent months, it's been that kind of challenge of, how do I make this work? What are the ways? Who's going to be the partner that's going to really believe in this conversation and helping to push it forward? Because if I'm not a sustainable business, that's not saying much.
Yeah, this is one of the great conundrums facing any content producer across any medium, I think, in the modern age. People are not used to paying for content. People expect to download music for free. They expect to get their journalism from newspaper sites online for free. And they expect to get their podcasts for free. It's really interesting, because I do think that people who consume content love it and they enjoy it. But for some reason, we've got to a point where people have been trained to think that it's free. And that's in that context, it's easy to forget that someone has to make it, and that person has to be a professional if they're going to do a good job. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, how do we solve it? Same with any kind of, you know, films even. We just have a culture where people expect to be able to take it for free.
Yeah, but at the same time, I feel like I wouldn't want to charge for this content, because I want people to have access to it as easy as possible. So I'm 100% on board with that mess that exists and how we think everything should be free. But I think having conversations like this available and accessible to anyone is really important, in not having it be something you have to pay for.
Yeah,
to get
me
access
too.
To.
So what's the answer? Side hustles. Left edit.
Side hustles, or finding someone who believes in the importance of it. I mean, you and I are on the cusp of the future. These are conversations that are just going to keep spiraling out and keep getting, you know, more and more intricate and more detailed. Even over the last little over a year that I've had Conscious Chatter, I've realized how much more intricate the conversation is getting.
I love that you use the word intricate. I do. Well, thank you for allowing me to take part in this conversation with you, Kestrel. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. I am very honored to be on your show.
Oh, yeah, you are so welcome. Cheers, mate. That's what we say in Australia. Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. To learn more about our guests and the issues that we've spoken about today, hop on over to my website, which is clairepress.com/podcast. You can get in touch there, and I really hope you will. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also find links to my social media. And finally, if you're enjoying the show, please head over to iTunes and subscribe. You know what they say, first in, best dressed. Subscribers are first to find out when there's a new episode, and it also helps other people discover Wardrobe Crisis, so I'd love your help with that. Because the more people who switch onto ethical fashion, the better. Music is by Montaigne. She recorded this special acoustic version of Because I Love You, which is from her Glorious Heights album, especially for Wardrobe Crisis. How good is that? Thank you, Montaigne. Because I love you. My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I tell you we're okay. I won't admit that I am blind. My friends don't feel that I'm carrying a steel. I tell them all that they are wrong. Because I love you. Because I love you. Because I love you, because I love you, because I love you.